Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Rare Bird Radio. I'm Rich Ferguson, L.A. poet, musician, and performer, author of the poetry collection Eighth and Agony, out on Punk Hostage Press, and you are listening to Poetescape. Welcome on this fine Sunday, St. Patrick's Day. Color my words green today, and with me as my guest is author Angela Stubbs. How are you, Angela?
Hi, I'm good. How are you?
Doing well. Thanks for being on the show today.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
I was wondering if you could perhaps launch in and read a poem for us. Maybe You Are, Here I Am.
Awesome. Yes, I can do that. Not do my poet voice.
We'll have to perhaps talk about that at some point. At some point, our quote unquote poet voice. Yes.
Yes. Okay. This is You Are, Here I Am. How do I address you? How do I call you doctor, mademoiselle, Ms., first name, last name, hyphen, attached last name here, mamala, mother, mamacita, and just that, just one thing, one letter, one time, only now, maybe then it will be the best right turn or right angles. Remember a time you told me about living? I'm doing it right now. Check this box. I am doing it. It was said over wires with tapping and dots. We were connected through sonar sound, found in water, waiting with hands to pull steady pieces from simian creases. An original, I fear you have a peculiar hand that resembles mine in a certain place. Your face next to the cheekbone of what Chiro calls a unique hand. High five me, whom we go palm deep. In grooves back 19 years, I write it again and again, reading and rewriting the message louder. Every sentence day before today, plus or minus 20, is right here when I add punctuation, say, here, right over here, lucky you, look here. I send repeat indigo ink under skin. Will you be here? Wait, while collecting dust and a bruise. I unarm you, Hatmaster, put this on. Find me on the parallax, won't you? I've been waiting here on the bottom of the heap for quite some time. Fingertips are trips within reach. If you are something akin to a perfect 10, it's the sum of equal parts 5 and 5. You have two sides. Be careful of square edges. Noting nothing tell you so much nothing, but dirty hair is a crime. Take the details and make them the currency I spend with you. Talk tea and wear fishnets and French flowers on your wrists. Your waist wastes away, bending over, halfway down laces, face the door and places you pass over choices, but leave a door open for Elijah. You listen, you hear, you query the queer girl who sits on leather, covered in boots, couch and cushion, wearing a gold lame skirt the issue. Push the pill, relax, and pull the pilling from your sweater. Wonder, is she getting better? Thanks.
Beautiful. Beautiful.
Thank you.
You know, you were talking about that poet voice before. It reminded me, a dear friend of mine, he was actually on my show a couple of weeks ago, actor, musician, James Morrison. And, you know, mm-hmm. I've definitely been guilty of that quote unquote poet voice before because, you know, I do a lot of performing. And
right.
James said to me one time, because I was looking for a way to sort of try to take the edge off some of that poet voice. And he said, you know, when you go through your work, think about it and practice it as if you were just speaking those words to someone you love dearly who is right in front of you. You know, you wouldn't put on that sort of affectation of poet voice. You would just be speaking those words in a very sort of gentle, personal way. And, you know, I started going through some of my own work that way, where I just was saying it as if I were just speaking the words to someone in a room with me. And I found that doing that with time, that definitely has sort of tempered that, you know, big sort of poetry voice a bit, so that there's not so much of a shift between my regular voice and, you know,
right,
when I step onto a stage. I mean, you know, there still is to some extent, because I sometimes perform with musicians and stuff, so I sometimes have to speak over that. But
right.
How about for you? I mean, because you brought it up. I mean, how do you notice that happening with you?
Well, it's really tricky. I think, especially reading a lot of work that I write kind of is not genre specific. So it is like this prose poetry kind of. There's this gray, very gray area in terms of how you define it. And I think unless I've written it in a way that I feel like when I'm reading something that is by and large what I would classify, I guess, as a poem, that it becomes difficult to navigate, and that you want to provide, especially if somebody's not in front of you hearing you, like maybe today like this, or when you're doing a reading and maybe somebody's hearing it but they're not seeing it. I think it's interesting just how people process the things how you perform, like when you are in front of an audience. I try to close my eyes when I go to readings and stuff, because I really want to hear the way that people speak, as opposed to like paying attention to like what they're actually doing while they're speaking. I feel like I get distracted. But I find that when you're around a bunch of poets, and like when I was away at school in Europa, there was just this onslaught of there was a lot of poet voice, where like everybody on purpose seemed to be really accentuating like line breaks and poems, and I think that that's fine, but it was so much so that everybody seemed like a cookie cutter of everyone else in terms of, you know, it became, I think, the quote unquote poet's voice took over that space, as opposed to like the actual words of this poem and the amazing thing that somebody had written that was they were trying to convey to people. So,
do you find that it sounds like what you're saying is, and maybe I'm wrong, but it sounds like that, and this is something I've thought about, that perhaps that poet, quote unquote, poet voice can actually get in the way of what you are actually trying to convey sometimes.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think it's true. I think it really depends on, you know, who's reading and what the work is. And you know, I think there are times where certain pieces do call for that to an extent. But I think it's really like not overusing it and kind of letting it serve its purpose to benefit the piece as best as it can. Because ultimately you want, you know, everybody, I would hope, you know, people write to have those words affect someone else. And, you know, I think this is really important to, you know, as long as it serves a purpose, I think it's fine. But when it becomes like the crutch, you know, it feels comfortable to do it too. It's like you don't have to really, like you were saying, just sit with those words and say them as if you were saying them to someone you do really care for. I think it really brings a certain amount of sincerity to the work.
And, you know, and it's like you said too. And it's not just for poetry, really. It's for anything we do. It's just like, what is it? What can we do to best serve our work? If it means we get up on, you know, if we rant our words, if we use a big voice like Dylan Thomas, you know, I love hearing recordings of him read or whatever, or like, you know, someone else I love who was also associated with Naropa, Anne Waldman. I mean, you hear
Anne is amazing.
I know, she's totally amazing. I mean, the first time I saw her, she totally blew me away. That was just like, she was like one of the first sort of quote unquote performance poets I saw when I was living in San Francisco. And that just sort of for me, kind of
insane. Yeah,
blew the doors open as far as what one could do with performance poetry. But yeah, and you know, and she was serving her work, you know, the way she was doing it serves the work. So yeah, I think you really hit it when it's just like, whether it's a whisper or a rage, we, you know, just don't get in the way of what we're trying to say and best serve it the, you know, the best way we can. You know, something we have in common, and, you know, perhaps we have many things in common, but one thing we definitely have in common is that we are both contributors at the Nervous Breakdown, that wonderful online literary experience started by Brad Listy. And for those listeners who aren't familiar with the Nervous Breakdown, it's at www.thenervousbreakdown.com. You should check it out. That's my little plug for Brad and TNB. Yes, but I'm curious, how did you get started with TNB?
Interesting kind of history. Todd Goldberg, the writer and awesome author of, he works at the MFA program in UC Riverside Desert.
He's
brilliant. And I knew him through UCLA Extension writing. And then after that, just, you know, I've always been very good at schmoozing and, like, you know, very chatty, as some people who know me really well are like, yeah, you never shut up. So, but I had this thing in common with Todd where, you know, he always kind of looked out for me, in terms of, you know, hey, there's this writing gig, or hey, this or that, or I want to introduce you to this person. And he introduced me to Gina Frangello when I was a writer at Bookfoot. And he had said, you know, oh, Gina had My Sister's Continent, was coming out at the time. It was maybe 2005 or six. And he introduced the two of us so that we could work with Susan Henderson, who was doing Lit Park at the time. And he kind of just made this love connection for us and said, all of you need each other, kumbaya, go forward. And we did. It was really amazing because I did an interview with Gina over at Lit Park, and then Gina became this great.
I love Gina, by the way. She's great.
She's one of the best people I know, and she's a brilliant writer, and I am so lucky to know her. And she also kind of, like, took me under her wing, and when the Nervous Breakdown was just starting to do reviews, she contacted me and said, I was talking with Brad and Shia, and you were, like, the first person I thought of, and we would want you to do something that's similar to this, you know, like Alyssa Chappell's Hot Type, Vanity Fair type thing, but maybe more in depth, and, you know, would you be interested? And it's like, well, of course. And always looking for an avenue to have good books sent to me that I can read, that I enjoy. But more than that, I really, at the time, took this opportunity the way I kind of was processing it, like this great gift that was being given to me, was that it was also an opportunity for me not just to kind of pick and choose my own work that I wanted to review or put out for others to take notice of. What I felt was really important about having something where I was choosing the content was to spend time reviewing and looking closely at the work of other female writers, especially debut writers, and work that, by and large, from smaller indie presses, because there are so many works that are overlooked in that regard, and I just felt like this is the perfect place, the perfect space for me to do that. And it's nice because you don't have someone telling you what you have to review.
Right.
It's really up to you. And so that was something that was really amazing about that opportunity. And so that's how that started. It kind of, I had to take a tiny break from it because I ended up going into a master's program, so that was really hard to navigate and, like, continue to do that work while taking full-time units and have a full-time job and that thing. So
now, because you get to review what you want to review, have you ever had to write a bad review at all, or do you, if something doesn't turn you on, do you just say, you know what, I'm not going to write about this?
I won't write a bad review. If I read something, I don't like it. I was about to say all my reviews are going to be super positive. I mean, I think it's only helpful for me to write a review that has constructive comments in it about something that I feel like, Dennis, you know, my as a reader, my experience, I felt like what the author did helped my reading experience in this way, and maybe this, that, and the other took away from it a little bit, but I don't feel like it's my place. You know, I don't know. I'm just, you know, I always think of reviewing as it's just somebody else's opinion, and who am I to, you know, kind of cut somebody down to size. So
sure.
I feel like, you know, my goal is to, if something doesn't resonate with me, I'm probably not, if I'm in the middle of it and if I'm just not loving it, I'm going to probably just put it down and
right. That's
it. And, you know, right. And that's kind of just how I've tried to be in terms of the reviews that I choose. I think there was maybe one book, I don't remember it well, except that there was only one that sticks out in my mind when I worked at Bookflip that I actually kind of didn't love, and I had already said I would review it. You know, at the time I was kind of stuck because I didn't have the same, like, kind of open-ended thing happening in the way that I did at the Nervous Breakdown, and I had already promised to review, and I just really didn't love it. And so that was hard for me. But
right.
I just kind of, you know, I feel like it doesn't necessarily, for me as a reviewer, serve a purpose to write a really negative review.
Yeah. Now, I know so. When you were young, you were actually a competitive swimmer, and you sort of had like a budding athletic career. I'm curious, what got you into writing?
Well, I was actually really, I was always very good at, like, as a little kid, as a younger kid, at writing, and, you know, I always excelled at stuff like that when I was younger, but I ended up, you know, where I grew up, which was in Central California, was very rural, and wasn't a lot going on there as a kid, even as, especially as you got older, definitely not a lot going on. You know, we'd have, like, parties up by a ditch, and,
right,
you know,
right.
It was not very exciting. Like, somebody had a keg, and, you know, we would go hang out at somebody's old barn, you know.
it's
and,
like the Little Rascals gone bad.
Yeah, it really was. I mean, and, you know, it's interesting. It was a really interesting place to grow up, but I was, you know, I was a swimmer. I always loved swimming. It's very hot there in the summers. Everybody has a pool. I was actually just really good at it. I don't, without really trying, I think in the beginning, you know, I was probably a little more average, but as time went on, I became a really, really good swimmer. And I think for a period of time, I thought I would have this amazing swimming career, and I would go to, you know, like the Pac-10 school and do that. And by the time I kind of hit my sophomore year of high school, I was done with swimming. And I loved it. I was actually very good at it, but I was bored. And I was very into theater when I was in high school. And, you know, I kind of thought I was going to be like the next Barbra Streisand, which was really hilarious because, you know, at the time I was not Jewish, nor was I like some amazing singer, but I had decided that like my ticket out of where I lived was that I was going to have this amazing career. And the things we tell ourselves, you know, and
yes.
I decided that I was going to, you know, kind of get out of town and move to Los Angeles. And I was always very good, like things that were, you know, any creative expression, art, you know, sort of theater, singing. I mean, I was okay. I wasn't bad. I wasn't amazing. I was, you know, I was average. But I was always a good writer. And I think I always felt when I was younger that it wasn't an impressive enough of a career move, like as a younger, like as a teenager. Well, that's just boring. Like I can write, but like who's going to do that for a living? Like me? I'm not going to do that. I need to be like something in life, you know, it needs to be fancy. And I think I had this idea in my head that I needed to be very important. And
right.
At that time, it just didn't seem like it. And then it wasn't until I went to Cal State Long Beach when I went away to college that I kind of discovered that, you know, that was really what I was good at, what I should be doing. I took a lot of classes because I think I changed my major about like 8 times. Because
mm-hmm.
I just couldn't settle on something. And I ended up being a screenwriting major in college. And but it was kind of by default. I felt like it was important to me in the film department to tell stories. And as a filmmaker, I felt like, you know, obviously the writing is an integral part of storytelling, but I also felt like film editing was a really important thing to do and to learn. And that was where I was at. That's what I wanted to do. Our program, you know, Cal State Long Beach doesn't have, like, this amazing film department. It has a good department, but it was understaffed, I think is the best way to put it. And it took a long time to get out of that department. And I switched my emphasis to screenwriting because it was faster to get out.
Right.
I thought, I'll just screenwrite. This is what I'll do.
Right.
This is it. And you know, the good thing is what I figured out in that process was that I'm a really good writer, but I don't love screenwriting really at all. Like, it's too confining. I don't like all the, you know, I don't like rules. So I thought, well, this is maybe not my thing. But I went through this process, and I had this amazing writer and instructor, Stephen Cooper. He's John Fonte's biographer, who is brilliant, and I adore him. He was my mentor, like, all through school. And he said, you know, Angela, why don't you, after I finally graduated, he's like, why don't you come to UCLA Extension and take a couple of classes and see how you like writing short stories, and which was kind of the beginning of my starting to really write poorly at the time, probably very bad short stories, but nonetheless, there it was.
Right.
So yeah.
You know, in reading some of your work, I've sort of seen this meditative quality at times, which made me think of Buddhism, which then sort of tangentially made me think of Naropa. And I know that you went to Naropa, the Jack Kerouac School of Disembodied Poetics. I was wondering if you might talk a little about that experience.
You know, Naropa is such an interesting place. And I know when I thought about going to a master's program, you know, Todd Goldberg was like, come to Palm Desert, don't go to Naropa. He was very critical of that decision. He encouraged me, highly encouraged me to come out to East Riverside. And I think it's a brilliant program out there. But I really felt like at the time I really wanted this contemplative aspect of learning in my life. I think it was just really it wasn't a coincidence, I think, for where I was at the time, that I felt like I needed that. And a good friend of mine, author Danielle Dutton, who I grew up with, actually, we grew up in the same small town in Visalia in the state, California. We went to school together, and she's obviously a, you know, well-respected writer and author, and she has her own press, Dorothy, a publishing project. I have to give her a little shout on that because I'm so proud of her. But she was finishing a PhD at DU and was adjunct faculty at Naropa. And I just always really respected, you know, a lot of her choices and the things that she did in terms of, you know, her own writing. And it just kind of put a, like, little bug in my ear in terms of where I was going to go and what I was going to consider. And I took a trip out to Boulder the year, like the winter prior to actually going to Naropa, and I was so surprised about it was nothing like I expected in, like, the best way, but I didn't really understand what my experience was going to be like at Naropa until I was really there in the summer when you do this residency. It's very intense. You know, they want you to meditate. It's not technically required meditation before you, you know, go to your workshops and classes throughout the day, but they offer meditation every single morning. There's a sitting meditation, and it is part of your curriculum. And to get my master's degree, I did have to take a certain amount of contemplative study, and I opted to do, you know, these meditation classes. And it really, at the time, I think, I felt like it might be a bit hokey. Like, is this really gonna inspire me? Am I gonna really feel centered? And is my work gonna become? Will I have, like, a clearer head to create if I'm doing this on a regular basis? And I wasn't really sure. I was a little skeptical because I'm very, like, ADD about certain things. Where, you know, I'm kind of like go 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 all the time. And so for me to sit with myself was really uncomfortable. I was like, let's hurry up and meditate.
Hurry up. Yeah. It's like people here in LA, right. Let's hurry up and go to a yoga class.
Yeah, let's hurry up. Let's do this. All right, let's go. Ready? So that was kind of where I was at. It was like, I have to hurry and do this. And it was so interesting what started happening. The more I started meditating and the more I started actually really doing it. But at the time, you know, also simultaneously annoyed and a little bit resentful of the fact that I had to do it because I was getting a grade, which seems also strange that you're getting graded in meditation. It's like, what's the criteria here for the grade? Like, you didn't sit right on the cushion. So, you know, it was just one of those things where it was really about learning like some Buddhist history, and it was kind of more on that end in terms of the grading and the Buddhist portion that you were actually receiving grades for, but you were required to do that. And in the end, it ended up being such an amazing thing. But when you're at Naropa, I think every summer that I, you know, I went for 2 summers for residency. I got through the program very quickly, 2 years. I had a meltdown every summer that I was there because it just makes you really hold a mirror to yourself. And like all the things that are really amazing about you and all the things that you don't like about yourself, like they're all there to look at. And it's just a very strange and amazing thing that happens when you go to Naropa. And sometimes you don't want to feel your feelings all the time. But at Naropa, somehow you are inadvertently exposed to things and people and situations that kind of force you to do that. And it's actually a really good thing, but it was necessary, I think, for me. I really think it's been a huge help with me just as a person and as far as my writing goes. It's been, you know, really transformative.
Excellent. You know, we're getting close to the end of our time. We have a few more minutes, and I want to make sure that we talk about a couple things first before the end of the show. To continue on this idea of schooling, I believe that you are currently in the application process to get a PhD, perhaps, at USC. Is that correct?
We'll see. I'm hoping. USC people, please, you know.
Amy Bender's in the program, right? She's teaching there?
Yeah, she's teaching there. She's on faculty, and I think it's Percival Everett.
Percival. I see him. He actually lives close to me. I see him every once in a while. He's great. Both of them are great. Amy's great. Percival's great.
Mm-hmm. I think it's Marianne Wiggins, and T.C. Boyle is there, but I heard he's maybe slowly retiring or leaving the program.
Okay.
So I don't know if that's 100% true or not, but that's kind of in a roundabout way what the word was.
And when are you going to find out about that?
I think it'll be supposedly within the next month or less. Like it would be by like mid-April, if not before.
Nice.
So that's, you know, they only take like between 4 and 6 people. It's really competitive. I mean, it's not like if they took 40, I'd feel better, you know.
Right.
And of that, it's, you know, it's like 2 poetry and 2, you have to declare an emphasis when you apply. So it's not just, you know, 4 to 6 of anybody. It's, you know.
Are you going for poetry?
Actually, I went for fiction.
Wow.
And
okay.
I actually was very conflicted about how to decide. And the reason I picked fiction is because I feel like, you know, I can do both. And it was funny because I went to visit the university and meet some people in the program prior to applying, and they had said, you know, we've only had one other student who, once they were actually in the program, had been lucky enough to publish a work of fiction and a work of poetry. And so in that regard, we kind of let them do their dissertation on whatever they wanted in terms of the focus being, like, related to poetry or related to fiction. You know, obviously you can have some crossover in terms of, you know, what your focus is or whatever. But I had a real problem declaring because I thought, well, you know, I'm very much in the middle. Like, I do not like rules. I keep saying this, but it's so true. I'm like, well, how about if we bend those? How about if I just, you know, how about if I just tell you that I would go for either and you tell me where you think my work falls, and then how about that?
Right.
That's not so much for the application process. So, yeah.
Got it. Well, I'm sending out good vibes for you, you know, just like whew, put them out in the poetiscape.
Yeah.
Atmosphere.
Thank you.
And, you know, I know that, yeah.
I was just going to say, Amy's amazing. And She's one of the reasons why, I just wanted to add quickly that, you know, one of the reasons I was really motivated to apply to USC is, well, one, obviously, I would love to stay in California because I want to have my life here, at least for now. And I really, really, I think it would be such a 180 in terms of experience from what I just had at Naropa. And I think it's always important to keep challenging yourself in order to grow. And as a writer, I think it would be a really great thing in that regard. But also, you know, Amy was, her collection, The Girl in the Flammable Skirt, was the first,
yep.
one of the first collections, short stories that I really, really loved and really motivated me in a way that other writing hadn't. And to be able to work with somebody like that and to have that person's work inform your own on that level on a regular recurring basis by being in a program, you know, where you have access to someone like that, it just seemed like a no-brainer kind of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, yeah. When that collection came out, she was actually teaching a short fiction writing class at UCLA and I took it with her and up to that point, I had never experienced someone who was so excited about writing and so good at it. And she just, when you were in her presence, it just radiated off her and you just wanted to be there and wanted to learn from her. And it was such a great experience that I had with her. Yeah.
Oh, that's
now,
great.
Yeah. So yes, we both share Amy. So there's another thing we have in common besides TNB. We both share Amy love. So yes.
Yes, we do.
Giving big shouts out to Amy Bender. Now I know you work at FX, which I know, you know, marketing and on air promotions, that to some degree must be a fairly stressful job and a busy job. I was wondering if you could maybe talk a little about that in these final minutes and talk about how you're able to balance that type of job with being able to find time to write.
Well, it's a little tricky. I mean, FX is, I'm so proud of this network that I work for. And, I work for, I think, probably the most brilliant woman in marketing in Hollywood. Stephanie Gibbons is just this amazing, amazing marketer and not just that, like she's a really creative genius and I'm so lucky to work with her every day. She's brilliant and the thing about it is that, you know, FX is becoming so much bigger as a network and you're going to start to see a lot of changes in terms of, like, you're going to see a lot more of FX on your television and I think in other capacities. And I don't know if I'm allowed to say more than that, but there's amazing things coming and I'm so excited for the network, but it is really busy and I've been complaining a lot lately, as I'm sure most of the people I work with are also very cranky and tired, because there's so much happening and we're just growing so quickly and we're trying to increase, the workload with, and share that workload with appropriate staff, which we have yet to acquire. So it does make it a little taxing, and it is hard to write. It was one of the biggest challenges I had while at Naropa because I was in that law residency program, and it was so hard to balance writing with that job. My boss was very happy when I graduated from that program. because my focus was not at that job. And it is very, very difficult. Right now, I work 10, I would say 10 hour a day, maybe more sometimes, but I would say a good 10 hours. And, and then I have to drive from Studio City into, near Century City. So that's a schlep for sure, but it's okay. I love the people I work with. They're like family to me. I've been there for 6 years, but I would love my work life to challenge me in a way that, you know, it is for, like, my boss is doing what she loves for a living. She's so passionate about what she does, and I so respect that. And I need, you know, I want my work life to reflect that as well. And I'm passionate about the people that are in my life, but I am not, in terms of what I'm doing to make, you know, make money and pay my bills right now, is not really reflecting in that way. So
Right. That's
kind of my my real trouble, I guess, in having a real
sure.
good job that pays your bills and provides me with a very nice life. I'm very,
yeah.
very grateful for my job there, but it is hard because I love writing. And so I pretty much write, you know, I always have notepad or paper, my actual iPhone notepad, which is funny too, to actually try to type stuff on that, but I like actual paper. And music inspires me. Anytime I hear, you know, something in the car, at home, wherever, whatever I'm doing, I'm constantly kind of just always taking notes. And sometimes, you know, it'll happen even at work where I will have to sit, like, during my lunch and start typing or writing something because, you know, how it is when it comes to you, you have to take it and
sure.
sit. So
sure.
sometimes it's not convenient, but there it is. And so I really writing kind of in these fits and starts, but I'm still very, very committed. I don't have, like, a routine on a daily basis or anything that I'm doing in terms of writing, except that I find that the more time I have to read, I write better always.
Sure.
And yeah, so I mean, I'm pretty much just writing as much as I can. I'm lucky that I've been still able to write pretty, you know, consistently during the week. I would say, you know, at least, you know, 2-3 days during the week at some point for a decent chunk of time. But I find that I fall asleep with, you know, papers and a laptop on me and, you know, books everywhere because
right.
I'm trying so hard to just come home and, you know, put whatever it is down on paper, and that doesn't always work out so well.
Yeah. Well, we're getting near the end here. Where can people find you online?
Well, mostly you can find me on the Nervous Breakdown, which is if you go to the Nervous Breakdown and or if you Google my name and Nervous Breakdown, I will be there. And there's a link to everything that I've done there. And then I think just in terms of, you know, finding work that's been published online, you can, I don't actually, I used to have a blog that I was very poor at keeping up to date. And so it kind of got abandoned, sadly. I think due to time constraints, haven't really put anything together as a central focus point for, you know, locating all the things that I've done or will continue to do. But maybe that's something I can work on. Yeah. So right now you can pretty much, or you can just Google Angela Stubbs writer.
Whole
plethora of items will come up and you can go crazy. Yeah.
And you've got a couple of manuscripts that you're shopping right now, right?
Yeah, I do. I'm actually very excited about it. And I'm hoping that they find a home. I was lucky enough to create both of them. One sort of prior to going to Naropa and then kind of fine tuning while at Naropa. And then the other one also was a byproduct of my time there. The first one is called Try to Remain Hidden. And it's just a collection of hybrid work. And I think about 3 or 4 people have it right now. And I know it's a long process. You know, people pick their time and letting me know what they think about it and, you know, whether or not it's a fit. And then the other is a book of poems called Apostrophic. And it is that one I'm still kind of, I keep tweaking. So I feel like maybe I need to spend a little more time with. But
mm-hmm.
yeah, I would really like for one or both of them to find a home soon.
Nice.
Well,
all the best with that too.
Thank you.
With me today has been writer and a very wonderful person in general, Angela Stubbs. This about wraps it up for another edition of Poetescape. This show has been sponsored by Rare Bird Lit. You can find Tyson Cornell and the lovely Julia online at rarebirdlit.com for all your writerly needs. You can find me, Rich Ferguson, online at wevoicing.com, on YouTube, Facebook. You can just Google my name, but be sure to put poet after my name, because there is also a magician named Rich Ferguson, and he is very good, but he is not me. But anyway, and the theme music for our show is by We Voice Sing. And thank you very much, Angela, and thank you very much, everyone, for listening in. And hope to have you tune in next week for another edition of Poet Escape. Happy St. Patrick's Day, everyone.
Thanks, Rich.